happened is a couple weeks ago, I said, hey, we'll do songs, and I've got a couple openings, and if you have ideas for songs, come talk to me. And Chris came up to me afterwards and mentioned this song, and I was like, I have no idea what that song is about. I've been hearing this song since 1984 and 1985 when this came out. I've heard that. How many of you know this song? How many of you were singing along during the meet and greet, right? Do you guys know this song, Caleb? No, you don't. I'm surprised sometimes at the song he does know on the radio, but you don't know this one. But you do, because you've seen the movie. So I've been listening to this song forever. How many of you have no idea what this song is about? All right, good. Because that, can we just be honest? There are so many songs that we listen to on the radio, and I could probably sing every word, except I know I was singing some words wrong now, because I've looked at the lyrics, because that's the thing too. But I had no idea what this song was about. Look at the lyrics for just a minute. So, won't you come see about me? I'll be alone dancing, you know it, baby. Tell me your troubles and doubts. Give me everything inside and out. And love's strange, so real in the dark. Think of the tender things that we are working on. Slow change may pull us apart when the light gets into your heart, baby. And then the don't you forget about me. And then, so that's part of, the first part there is all about like intimacy, right? Like we've shared these things, we've had these struggles. And then the chorus, don't you forget about me. So will you stand above me, look my way, never love me. Rain keeps falling down, down, down. Will you recognize me, call my name? This is the best line in the whole song. Call my name or walk on by. Don't try and pretend it's my feelings will win in the end. I won't harm you or touch your defenses. So in the end, the song is like, so fine. You won't remember me. I won't bother you either. Like I'll walk away. As you walk by, will you call my name? As you walk by, do you guys know where this song comes from? Anybody? Somebody said it over here. It comes from The Breakfast Club, the movie The Breakfast Club. This song, no, not just that. It's the soundtrack to The Breakfast Club, Judd Nelson. But more importantly, this song was written while the movie was in production. John Hughes had the guys who wrote the song. There's a team of three guys that wrote the song, mainly two. He had them start watching the film, what they had cut so far. And literally, this song was written specifically out of the movie The Breakfast Club. Like, how do we write a song that encapsulates that movie really well? And there's a particular scene in the movie where the writers of the song talk about, we saw this scene and this song came out of that scene. And so let me tell you how it kind of went. So they wrote the song, and then there's a couple different versions, but the version I heard is they asked Simple Minds to do it, and they said no, because they had never done a song that they didn't write themselves. They didn't want to do a cover. So then the producers asked Billy Idol, who said no for whatever reason. And then they asked several people, and then they went to the Pretenders and asked the Pretenders, but she was pregnant at the time, and she was married. I don't know if she still is, but she's married to the lead singer for Simple Minds, and she's like, no, you guys ought to do this song. So they went in the studio and did it. One other little fact about this song. So this song then became, I mean, huge. It blew up all over the world. Because the movie was huge. And then the other thing to know is in the movie, The Breakfast Club, when you know you have an awesome job, when on my to-do list this week was watch The Breakfast Club. So Tuesday night at home, I'm like, Jennifer, I got to work. I'm going to watch Breakfast Club. So which was awesome. I haven't watched it in years. It's been so long because we were meeting Wednesday morning, so I had to get all fresh again. Just interesting. If you watch The Breakfast Club, because now you're all going to want to go watch The Breakfast Club this afternoon, because we're going to talk about it for a long time this morning. The beginning, when it plays, this is the song that's playing when the credits come up. It's the demo version that has the writer of the song singing it. And then at the end of the movie, in this scene, it's Simple Minds singing it. So this is the scene. I want you to see this scene in The Breakfast Club that inspired the song. So go ahead and roll it.
What is going to happen to us on Monday when we're all together again? I mean, I consider you guys my friends. I'm not wrong, am I?
No.
So on Monday, what happens?
Are we still friends, you mean? We're friends now, that is?
Yeah.
You want the truth?
Yeah, I want the truth.
I don't think so. With all of us or just John? With all of you?
That's a real nice attitude, Claire.
Oh, be honest, Andy. If Brian came walking up to you in the hall on Monday, what would you do? I mean, picture this, you're there with all the sports. I know exactly what you'd do. You'd say hi to him, and when he left, you'd cut him all up so your friends wouldn't think that you really liked him.
No way.
Okay. What if I came up to you? Same exact thing.
You are a...
Why? Because I'm telling the truth? That makes me a...
No, because you know how that is to do to someone, and you don't got to stand up to your friends and tell them that you're going to like who you want to like.
Okay, what about you, you hypocrite? Why don't you take Allison to one of your heavy metal vomit parties? Or take Brian out to the parking lot at lunch and get high? Or what about Andy, for that matter? What about me? What would your friends say if we were walking down the hall together? They'd laugh their asses off, and you'd probably tell them that you were doing it with me so they'd forgive you for being seen with me.
Don't you ever talk about my friends. You don't know any of my friends, you don't look at any of my friends, and you certainly wouldn't condescend to speak to any of my friends. So you just strip to the things that you know. Shopping, nail polish, your father's BMW, and your poor, rich, drunk mother in the Caribbean.
Shut up!
And as far as being concerned about what's going to happen when you and I walk down the hallways of school, you can forget it, because it's never going to happen. Just bury your head in the sand and wait for your prom.
I hate you.
Yeah? Good.
Okay, then I assume Alice and I are better people than you guys, huh? Us weirdos. Would you do that to me?
I don't have any friends.
Well, if you did.
No. I don't think the kind of friends I'd have would mind.
I just want to tell each of you that I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't, and I will not. Because I think that's real.
Your friends wouldn't mind because they look up to us.
You're so conceited, Clint. You're so conceited. You're so, like, full of yourself. Why are you like that?
I'm not saying that to be conceited. I hate it. I hate having to go along with everything my friends say.
Well, then why do you do it?
No, I don't...
That's intense. So in all of the John Hughes movies, next to every scene in Christmas Vacation, that's the best scene probably he ever did, right? Like that, that's so good. So I'm just curious as we start this out, how many of you, there's probably a fair split in here. Like how many of you were born after, should we do this, what year? Like it came out in 85. How many of you weren't
even alive?
How many
of you watched it when it was first released?
Okay, about half the room. I didn't, because we weren't allowed to watch rated R movies in my house, so I had to sneak it a couple years later. I had to get the DVD, and then I had to sneak it. No, VHS.
So I was raised on television, so yeah. I could watch whatever I want.
So let's start there. Like, I'm curious for, well, okay, I want to do two things. One is for all of you that were born post-1985 and have no idea what we're talking about when we say The Breakfast Club, can you give us the brief synopsis of what this movie's about? We should have done that maybe before the clip. It might have made more sense. And then I'll ask my next question.
Yeah. So it's a Saturday morning detention. And there are, what, five kids that are all mm-hmm. from uniquely different walks of life that have to come together and endure this tyrant of a teacher's punishment for various crimes committed against fellow students.
Yes. Right. Right.
And in the midst of all of that, they find some commonalities and real connection and community, maybe in ways that they don't experience in the rest of their world.
Yeah. So that scene is actually just a smaller part of a much bigger scene where they all finally kind of confess how they ended up in detention and kind of their real raw stuff.
That's what really struck me about this movie was just the vulnerability that was modeled in it, which is so uncommon in that stage of life,
oh,
I think.
Oh, absolutely. So let's get to that. Let's hold that. Let's pause there. Let's talk about like a little bit context of this movie. Why is it big for you? Why is it big for so many of us that were alive or that age in the 80s? I was a little young for that, but...
Yeah. I was a latchkey kid. Right, I came home every day after school. Both my parents were gone, and I was raised by Mr. Seaver. Who knows who that is?
I do.
Okay, for those of you who don't, he just died. He was the father from Growing Pains, Alan Thicke.
Show me that smile again.
Yeah.
That's sad.
The smile's gone. Yeah. So, like, literally, 2016 destroyed my entire childhood.
Right.
Like, you understand that. Like, all these icons that passed away parented me, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
They raised me. I learned...
Who else? Carrie Fisher.
Prince.
I learned a lot of things from Prince.
Bowie.
Mrs. Brady.
Mrs. Brady passed away, right?
Oh, Leon Russell. Who's that?
I'm not sure. Bowie.
Oh, Bowie. Yeah.
But
it's
right.
Been a big. You're right.
It
a lot
is.
Of '80s
it's
icons.
Huge, right.
Yeah.
Like, imagine going to a family reunion, i.e., turning on the television and then not seeing your family anymore.
Right.
And
right.
They're gone. Yeah. So, I mean, like, I learned. You know, like, I was raised on pop culture.
Yeah.
My dad sold door-to-door gaming consoles. Before they were, like, commercially sold in stores. So Colecos and Intellivisions and Ataris were sold door-to-door. And he did that. So I was raised on gaming. And then my stepmother, she ran the first family video. What did you call it the other day, though?
Family video and porn.
Well, yeah, sorry. right. It's such a weird thing, right?
It's so weird that they call it family video.
Yeah, except for the back
anyway,
room, like,
and now it's pizza and pizza
and pizza.
Yeah, whatever.
And so we had betas. Oh, who remembers the Betamax, right? And so that's what we would do. I would go and visit my father on the weekends, and we would watch movies on Laserdisc and Beta and Laserdiscs. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I learned about love from John Cusack films.
Yeah.
Right. Come on, who doesn't just get all, like, in the feels when
this
In Your
favorite.
Eyes comes on? Oh, yes, right? Just lifting the boombox.
The boombox.
Right. Yeah. I also that learned so from John Cusack that you better pay the newspaper boy.
Yeah. I want my $2.
$2, there you go. Yeah, Bet's better off dead. If you haven't seen it, you need to.
Yes. So when you came up to me, when I said we're going to talk about a series, about talking about different lyrics, and so let me give you a little bit behind the heart for this series. One is Lent is coming. Dun, dun, dun. And Lent's always a really heavy season. It just is. And I promise it will be this year too. Keep putting the Lent back, putting the sorrow back in Lent. That's our theme. Anyway, and so when the formation team was talking about this season of the year, in the liturgical calendar, this is a season of light. And so liturgically, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to talk about all the stories of Jesus being light in the world. We decided to talk about, like, all the places of light in popular culture. And so as just a little bit of twist on that, and to keep it, well, light, a little bit lighter. But there's this value we have as a church that everything is spiritual. Everything is spiritual. So, and maybe even, like, something that's in our lives day to day, like music permeates our lives, and there's so much spirituality in music. And most of the time, like I said at the beginning, I just miss it, or we just miss it, or we don't even know what that, like, some of us are really lyrics people and some of us really aren't, like, and so why, when I said, hey, this series lyric, we're going to talk about lyrics and spirituality of lyrics, why did this jump out at you and so start connecting that for us?
Yeah, so I resonated with this film because I think as an adolescent, I felt an awful lot like Brian in the film that I was just walked by all the time. Mm. Right? That I was the one that was forgotten. And so most of my adolescent behavior, and some of this rolled over into my young adult days, and I'm still peeling away layers of this now. So much of my behavior is just overcompensating for that feeling of not being seen.
Mm.
So the vulnerability and the rawness in this film that's captured in this song just resonated deeply with me. And because everything is spiritual, this was a spiritual journey for me of coming into my Imago Dei.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I love that. And so this idea of... this song is so poppy, like, it's so perfect 80s with the synths and all that stuff. But really, the message of the song is really sad. And so for me, my favorite part in that scene, and maybe my favorite part in the whole movie, is when Claire says, like, no, I wouldn't talk to you. And Brian, just that tear down Brian's face, like the hurt he feels, like in that moment, like I'm raw, I'm being vulnerable with you. And the reality is you will, you're going to walk right on by me on Monday morning. Like that to me is like the, oh, the moment of this film, like just so good.
Yeah. I think,
that's not a question.
No, that was just I know. I'm just I think it was the emotionality of the film.
Yes.
Coupled with the song, coupled with the spectacular writing and acting of that,
yep,
that group of, at the time, were peers, mm-hmm, you know, growing up, was profoundly impactful, yeah, on me. I think a lot of John Hughes films felt that way as well. Maybe not Beethoven, but a lot of, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pretty in Pink,
yeah,
that coming of age story.
St. Elmo's Fire. Was St. Elmo's, yeah, Fire him? No, St. Elmo's Fire is not him, but it was awesome.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do we walk away? How do we hear this lyric, and how do we walk away? How do we think about this lyric, and how does this connect us back to our lives here?
Yeah. So to continue with the theme of vulnerability, I developed an nasty drug problem when I was in high school. In fact, if I'm being honest, I used to sneak out of my house at night and go over to Angie's parents' house and hang out with them, right? Because I didn't...
You just got thrown under the bus.
I just totally threw under the bus. I didn't do drugs at Angie's house. It was the safe place for me. It was my escape. And her and her twin sister would be asleep, and I'd hang out with her mom. And I just had this sanctuary of where I felt people saw me, where I could be seen and heard and taken seriously, where I felt like I mattered. And then when I wasn't there, I was wanted. And it was just safe. And so, I got a taste of what that could be like. And that gave me hope. And then later, the drugs, of course, stole that from me. And then I discovered Narcotics Anonymous, which was a whole nother level of vulnerability and acceptance and vulnerability and community and belonging. And that set a bar really high for me as far as what I was looking for and hoping for and trying to build into my life, yeah, in a permanent, sustainable way. And so that sense of community they experienced on that awful Saturday morning resonated with me, and it really painted a picture of what I could or what I wanted in life. And I no longer wanted to be somebody that people would walk by, but no longer I wanted to be somebody that I would just walk by other people. And so cultivating that fellowship that I craved was really important. And I in my own heart, because I was raised on this stuff, that was a catalyst that said, go find this, go build this, right? And so... Like everything else paled in comparison after that. Once you experience a vulnerable community where you can be authentic, you can say, man, I'm a mess and I feel like I'm really screwing up this parenting thing. And I'm not sure I even know who I am, or today I don't even know if I love my spouse. Right? Like I look in the mirror and I hate what I see when I get out of the shower. Right? Like to have a community of connection, you can never settle for anything less than that. And so you spend most of your life, I think, most of my life, pursuing that. And now I get to be, as a counselor, as a therapist, I get to be part of helping create and cultivate those same communities so that others can experience it as well. And that's a powerful use of one's life.
Yeah,
I think.
So vulnerability over the last couple years. So 3 years ago, I think, is the first time I saw Brené Brown's TED Talk on vulnerability. And there's a sense in which it can become buzzwordy. Like, we're going to be real vulnerable, like that thing. So talk to me about a case for vulnerability. And then I'm going to ask you secondly, because now, I don't know if everybody here knows what you do. Tell them real quickly, what do you do?
I do a lot.
Things. You do a lot of things.
The primary things. I work for a methadone clinic where I work with people who are IV heroin dependent or opiate dependent on prescription narcotics or heroin. But I also spend quite a bit of time investing in youth workers around the country on helping them understand mental health related issues with teenagers that they work with, and
right,
trying to help them figure out how do we build a community where marginalized youth find that same sense of belonging that I longed for when I was their age.
Yeah. So when I think of what you do, much of this idea of vulnerability kind of threads through a lot of the different things right. you do. Talk to me about what vulnerability means. I'm going to put a quote that you gave me earlier in the week.
So, we talk about Brené quite a bit. I love this quote. When we sacrifice authenticity in an effort to manage how we are being perceived by others, we often get caught in a dangerous and debilitating cycle. Shame or the fear of being shamed moves us away from our true selves. So shame was my love language for a long time, right? This concept that I was just not enough no matter what I did. And in order to experience any kind of connection with you, it was shame-based. And I had to, there was a part of me that even sought that out, you know, because I didn't know how to interact with people that were healthy. I wasn't healthy. Mm. My own self-talk was shame-based. You're not a good enough son. You're not a good enough father. You're not a good enough this. You're not enough this. You're not enough that.
So when you say you relate to people through shame, explain, like, give me a sample conversation. What does that look like?
So rather than being affirming, we would spend all of our time together tearing each other down, but playfully.
Okay.
Right? We were dream stealers. So when somebody, I heard this great story years ago, I don't know if it's true or not, but I love the analogy about lobsters. And then if you put one lobster in a lobster tank, it'll crawl out, right? But if you put multiple lobsters in a lobster tank and one tries to crawl out, the others try to pull it back in.
Okay.
Right? And I like that seems like the shame culture I was a part of was anytime any one of us tried to get healthy, we would just, nope, you don't belong out there with the normal people, and we would pull them back in. Mm. And we do that through shaming language and toxic relationships, codependency.
Who are you to get better?
Who are you? Don't get better. Because if you get better, and then we have to own our own stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As well. Yeah. Because if you're saying that this is not healthy, and I'm engaged in the same behaviors, then I also likewise have to acknowledge that that's a... So we would... our conversations... were not conversations that build each other up. They weren't necessarily overtly abusive, but we did not believe in the best of each other. We would power up on other people to make ourselves feel better.
Yeah.
We always had the one guy, right? There was the one guy in your group that everybody makes fun of. Hmm. And if you can't think of it, it might be you. Sorry. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. See, that was the kind of thing that we would do. But we always had that one person that existed in our context, in our group, that his main purpose was to make us feel better about ourselves.
Hmm. Wow. So what is the shift then? What is it? Okay, so let's name the elephant in the room. Churches historically haven't been known as places of vulnerability. That is not, I don't know if you know this or not, but the MO of church is not vulnerability. It's generally like, we know what we're doing, we have it together, we're better than you, or we have the answer and you don't. And so one of the things that's been true of us as a community, I think most of the life of our church, and then Brené Brown has given us words to this, I think, is trying to create spaces of vulnerability. So what does that look like in your life as a practice? And then I'm going to come back later and ask, like, and how much is too far? And how do we wrestle with some of those things?
Sure. So, I mean, I love Brené stuff because she did. She gave a language to all of us who are on this journey. But I think healthy communities, at least the ones I've been a part of, make space for vulnerability. And then when somebody takes that risk, they honor the vulnerable risk that they took. It's really, really easy. Sometimes when people share something really, really vulnerable, we have a tendency to try to shut them down because that makes me feel really uncomfortable, mm-hmm. right? The first thing we do when somebody starts crying is what? We hand them a box of Kleenexes. Here you go, stop crying. Instead of being in that awful space with them, like the first thing, my natural inclination is just to shut it down.
Well, I think some people have different responses. Some people have the shut it down. Some people make jokes.
Yes.
Right? Some people change topics.
But it's to alleviate the tension.
Right. Some people try to fix it.
Yep.
Like you share something that's really authentic and real and vulnerable, and I go into like, oh, well, it's not that bad. I can fix your problem right away. Like, we all have our own ways, but what's common to all of those ways, and we've probably all been in groups where you see this happening, somebody starts to share something that's vulnerable and real and true, and then somebody else in the group, here's the way I often see it. Somebody else in the group feels uncomfortable, so they try to, whatever method they use, shut it down. Let's get back to AFC championship game today. Yes. Like, whatever. Right. Like, let's get it back to up here.
Right. So I just think it's that fear of shame. If you've ever thrown something out there, kind of test of the waters, right? And to kind of see how people are going to respond before you share a little bit more and divulge themselves. I think that's pretty normal behavior.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm not just going to cast my pearl to swine.
Right.
In a sense. But
I tell a story. I think I've told it here before about years. This is years ago. I had an ethical choice I had to make about how honest I was going to be about something. And my honesty was going to like cost me hundreds of dollars. And I didn't have to. And I remember sharing this with a friend of mine. And his response was something like, well, like, don't be stupid. Or like something really like, and I was like, I know the right thing to do. I'm struggling in it. And I needed some empathy. I needed some, like, me too. And so, like, that was it. Like, I the next time I felt something that I wanted to share, I was not going back to that guy. And we were friends. And I, you know, like, it was good.
Right.
But not vulnerable.
When we teach conflict resolution or communication skills for couples in group, we often talk about starting with a place of understanding.
Yeah.
But often when somebody shares something, our first inclination is, well, let's fix it.
Yeah.
Right? And so teaching people how to listen.
Yeah.
How to listen well and to seek to understand the other person and to listen with the intent to understand, not for them to stop so you can say something in rebuttal.
Right.
I think that creates that's a practical thing that creates space for vulnerability.
Yeah.
But you're right. If you throw it out there a little bit and then somebody responds with some kind of negative, toxic, shame-based response, I'm pulling back into my shell again because you're not safe.
Right.
I also think there are different spaces in which what we share is appropriate and what's not. Like if you and I are talking about intimate, let's say, sexual issues, right? Mm-hmm. And you're my pastor and my counselor, I'm sharing things with you, that's one thing. That's an appropriate space for that.
Right.
Out here might not be. Right?
I would say it's not.
Right.
Take the mite away from that.
Right. take the mite away, right? So I think there are different spaces that require or allow for different levels of vulnerability as well. Yeah. And sometimes people struggle to discern which space is appropriate for sharing.
Yeah, and for me, I think one of the things I've had to learn, because I'm pretty verbal. If you don't know me outside of this context, I'm pretty verbal all the time. And one of the things I've been learning is that dance of paying attention to how lopsided this is. Like, boy, it seems like every time we get together, I'm sharing all my junk with you, and you're playing wise sage with me. In time, I'll be done with that. Because I'll realize that, wait, we're not doing this together. And it really is this dance of, like, sharing. And I've learned, I guess, at 40, almost 43 now, I'm becoming more aware of, hey, there's people that want to go on this vulnerability journey, and there's people that just don't. Let them off the hook. Like, I don't have to force them. I'm not going to keep sharing my stuff with them so that they can, like, one, for their own, like, there's a certain enjoyment maybe I think sometimes we have about, wow, I want to know all the details about that person. But, like, I think that's one of the important life skills is, like, knowing this relationship is a safe one, a healthy one. It's going back and forth. And it's different. It's different. I'm sorry, I'm taking this all away from you. And it's different when I'm in my official pastor role, where it is my job. It's your job as a counselor to just, I don't expect everybody in the church to come in my office and say after every meeting, like, and Charlie, how are you? Why don't you share about yourself? No. That's different. I'm talking about, like, personal relationships. It can't, you know, if I meet with a, you know, you all know what I'm saying.
I get it. As a counselor, it's my job to listen.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And it's not uncommon to have a client come up to me and say, how's your week been? How are you doing? What's new with you?
Yeah, that's not why we're here.
I'm like, that's not why we're here.
Right. I have places to do that. It's not this place.
Sometimes it's hard to shut it off, though, because when I go home, it's, how are you? How are things going? And then somebody asks me the same thing. I'm like, I'm good. But really, tell me about you.
Right.
And so that can impact my connections out in the world, too, when I don't oscillate between those roles very well.
Yes. When I try to pastor my wife,
yeah,
it doesn't go well.
When I try to – I remember my son – I remember – I had a hard time shutting that off. He struggles with mental illness, and so when I would come home and I would help him try to navigate certain emotional crises, right. He'd go, "I'm not one of your clients."
Ah.
I was like, "But you need fixed." Because I'll feel better about myself.
Right. Right. Yeah. So what's the takeaway for this So let me go back to the lyric. So in the context of the movie, which it's really so the movie we just said when we met this week, like this movie holds. Like I haven't seen it in years and years and years. And I watched it, like I said, Tuesday night, and man, it holds up. I mean, there's quirky 80s things and all that stuff, but the concepts hold up. And there's these moments we have where we find ourselves in very, very vulnerable spots, where you've gone on any retreat or you've, like, let's say, like, we've gone to Honduras together and we've had this deep bonding experience. Applications are due by the end of the month. And, announcement. And let's just use that. Like, we've gone and then we have this deep bonding experience. And then what? And then maybe you come back and you're not so close anymore. Or how does this work and what does it look like and how do we think about that? Because, I that's the tear in the movie of the sadness of, okay, so I know, my own youth pastor stuff. There was a part of me that every time I came back from a trip, like I'd taken my kids, and we had gone somewhere and like had a trip together for a week and then we would come back. And there was like a sadness I was, and this is pre our own kids to deal with, to love, and not even paying attention to me. He's paying attention to your daughter. sorry, I shouldn't have embarrassed you like that.
Now they can't be vulnerable anymore.
Right. There was always a sadness I felt. Like that we had these intimate, vulnerable spaces, and now then they're gone. Then you move away from them. And talk about that a little bit, because that's the song. That's what that scene in the movie is. And you and I think you and I, or did I have another conversation with somebody where we actually played out like the, what do you think actually happened on Monday morning when they went back to school?
Right. Like, yeah, well, I think we had that conversation over breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, that's the hardest part, right? Because it's like, man, I got it. I got everything I've been longing for, and then it's gone. And I don't know if that level of vulnerability is sustainable all the time. Like, could you imagine, like every conversation you had was just really intense, and like when people asked you how are you today, they really meant it. Like that would be overwhelming. It's like, well, I don't know. Today I'm just feeling a little fat and unworthy of love. You know, it's like,
and to be fair, even in the
he was totally vulnerable, and then I just changed subjects. But we do this all the time, so I'm just a really negative example. But to your point, in the movie itself, I don't know, because it's probably been forever since most of you've seen it. Do you know what scene happens right after this?
Yeah.
It's them all dancing in the library. It's the crazy, like, we were just...
I've just shedded these heavy things.
Yeah, we just had all this really heavy moment. Now we just need to dance.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great. But there's that too, is that after I've been vulnerable, after nothing can sustain that, mm-hmm. and there needs to be, and that's why I think in what makes a marriage so great is marriage is a space of deep vulnerability, hopefully if you're doing it right, mm-hmm. it's deep vulnerability, but then there's lots of play, and there's lots of work that go, like,
yeah.
play and work and vulnerability all sit together, and they aren't just therapy all the time.
Right.
Well, I want every relationship, every conversation with your counselor to go there.
Sure. You set a new bar,
yeah.
or a new expectation. So I think we talked about this when I think what happened probably Monday morning was there was still this uncomfortable tension of how do we navigate this public space together, having had this transformative experience. So there were probably Ally Sheedy's character and Anthony Michael Hall probably talked to each other in the hallways. I'm not sure Claire did, but there was probably a knowing glance as they walked down the hall that said, "I see you." And that might be enough, right? The end of the movie, of course, when Claire and Bender kiss and he puts in the earring, right? And it's this moment of triumph. Like you can't ever forget that. Like that happened,
Like that really, that happened. And so every time you see them, there's a shared experience. I could talk all day about the neurobiology of oxytocin and what occurred and attachment and connection and what's happening in the brain. Like you can't undo that. You know, like that happened and you can't undo that. And so I think there's always going to be this pursuit of recapturing that in those relationships or other relationships.
There's always that sense. We were talking, he and I, because we both had youth ministry. Well, you're still doing, like, involved in youth ministry stuff, and it's more in my background these days. But my youth group, when I was a youth pastor, we had one high school. So all my kids went to Pekin High School. And it was really interesting. I always wondered, like, in our youth group space, it was really, I think I've shared this before, our youth group space was amazing because we had, like, cheerleader, Pekin High School cheerleader, basketball player crowd. We had Dave Crow punk crowd. We had nerdy kids. We had the Notables, which was the show choir kids. Like, we had just this odd collection. Like, right, Isaac? Like, it was an odd collection of friends. And I always said, like, I wanted to be a fly in the wall in the high school because my guess was Monday morning in the high school, these kids could sit on Sunday night and have these vulnerable for high school kid kind of, like, we had those kinds of moments in our youth group talking about real stuff, and I always wanted to be a fly on the wall and say, like, what happened at Monday at school when Ashley the cheerleader walked by Dave the punk? What happened there? And I never expected that they were like, oh, we're great friends, but that there was still the look, you know, we know we have something in a different spot, but it's not here. I don't know. It's just an interesting way of navigating that.
We talked a little bit about, and again, this was adolescence, and it was 30 years ago, but the social structures that were represented in here, that hierarchy of cliques, right? And so you had Claire and you had Emilio Estevez's character. Yeah. They were at the top of the ladder, right? And then everybody else was positioned appropriately all the way down, with Bender probably being at the bottom, just slightly above Andrew, yeah. Right? And so you had that, huh? Honors.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there were these levels of hierarchy that existed, and the goal of adolescence at the time was what? Climb the ladder as high as you can, but you can only achieve if you're invited, right? Yeah. Bender was not just going to hang out in Claire and Andrew's group at all without an invitation, and nor did he probably want to. But there's been so much change, and I think this was a great example of that. Chap Clark, in his book, who's a professor from Fuller, who studies youth ministry and just adolescent life, said that the social structure has changed a lot today, and it's moved away from this hierarchy to more of a lateral clustering of students, like you saw in that film clip where there was just a handful of kids that were from different walks of life that had to connect together to survive that experience that day. And that the world we live in actually lends itself more to the clustering rather than the clique hierarchy, but I digress, and I could go on and on with that for...
So we're running out of time. So let me kind of bring us to a landing spot, is how, from your perspective and your experience in youth ministry and everything else, and think about this, how do we create spaces of vulnerability in the church? Like, how do you create those kinds of spaces? And understanding, I think that's important too, to recognize that I might have a space of vulnerability here, and I might have other spaces that I sit in that aren't that same thing, and that's okay too. But my desire is that everybody has some space where they can say the truest things they can say about themselves, and it's reciprocated, and it's honored, and it's held, and they're not trying to be fixed or whatever. Maybe one or two things. What are steps people can take towards
I think you do a fantastic job of modeling that from a peer. I think seeing it, making fun of yourself, and taking risks to share appropriately here, I think is a great model. But I think so much of that happens organically. As well, I think you can try to cultivate it. Having been part of a church where small groups and life groups were like a core DNA, that always felt really forced to me. It's like, okay, sign up. Now you 10 strangers are going to do life together, right? And it's like, holy cow, like how do we do that? Like, that seems complicated. But the most authentic conversations I've had, the most vulnerable ones, have always been at coffee down at 3030 or back in the day at One World when it actually served coffee. So, I mean, like those are the vulnerabilities, right? Those are the spaces. So I think creating just more opportunities where we can hang out with, like, unstructured downtime. I love the breakfast with pastors. Like, it's not much of an agenda or brunch, right? Yeah. Like, let's just get together and just be together. You know, I think today, the Super Bowl playoff, the NFL playoff parties, I think you'll see pockets of vulnerability pop up as people get to know each other. But we got to make space for people to be themselves, and I think we have to fight and name shame when it happens. I think we just have to resist that.
Oh, can I tell one quick story? Is it okay? About how shame.
You're on the show here.
All right. So recently, I was paying attention. I need to be very vague on details, but I was in a situation where, you know, bullhorn guy, the people like stand on the street with the bullhorns and proclaim everybody's going to hell. I was in a situation in a very public space where somebody did something like that. Is that enough detail? And I just had to get out of the room as fast as possible. Like, I just knew that in me, my skin was crawling, and I felt very uncomfortable being in the space where a Christian was standing up and, like, preaching at a bunch of people. And I raced out of the place as fast as I could because I was really uncomfortable, and Gavin was with me and was like, what was that all about? And I was like, well, I don't know, I just have to get out of here. And later I was reflecting on it with Jennifer, and I said, you know what it is that it triggered all my shame. Like, it was about my shame of, like, being my own thing, and I don't even know who I relate with most in there. But I was the dorky Christian. In my own mind, I was the dorky Christian kid that wore weird clothes to school and had to have a short haircut all the time. That was how I saw myself in those years. And all of that was, like, right there. Like what you said, the very first thing you said about we're always still in some ways fighting our own high school battles. In that moment, all of a sudden, I was 17 years old again and so full of, like, here we are, the Christians being weirdos again. And recognizing, and I felt like it was like a proud moment for me, like recognizing, like, oh, this is what shame does. Shame makes me want to run out of the room as fast as I can because I can feel myself getting hot and I can feel like there's something going on. And noticing that and recognizing those spaces where, oh my gosh, this is shame right here. This is shame controlling how I'm acting. And being able to identify that is a big journey. That's a big step on my journey.
And we can't go into this today, but schemas. Jean Piaget developed this concept around schemas. And these are just false narratives we tell ourselves about ourselves and the world that we live in. And we develop those in childhood and adolescence. Yep. And then they are largely sustainable throughout adulthood.
Yep.
And they're stable. And so we spend most of our adult life just figuring out what those are, challenging them, and trying to replace them when we can.
Sure.
So they're always there.
Yeah. There's more to this conversation. If you want to talk more about vulnerability, Chris is a great person to talk to. Dustin is as well. I mean, because that's kind of what we're trying to do, even in Suppers for Sixes, is create, which he's going to promo right now. Why don't you come grab his mic? In the Supper for Six environment, that's what we're trying to do, is try to provide an environment where we can't say with any certainty, if we put six random people together at a dinner table, that they're all of a sudden going to have this vulnerable, emotional, let's cry together dinner. But sometimes it happens. Sometimes when you sit in people's homes and you sit around a dinner table, somebody shares something, and then somebody else goes, me too. And then it snowballs. And so we think that the sometimes is worth the effort. And so we just keep doing it and keep putting people together in spaces and say what happens. So will you talk to them more about Suppers for Six?